Perhaps this scientific method could be extended to other fields of learning. Perhaps I could lead the way to a new age. An age of rebirth. A renaissance. Nah.
Hello, my name is Nick Ebden, and you are listening to the Hypnosis Discussion Network podcast. Thank you for joining us again for episode 3 of the Hypnosis Discussion Network podcast. This week, we're absolutely delighted to be welcoming Howard Cooper. Now, for those who don't know Howard Cooper, he's a professional hypnotist and hypnotherapist who actually earns money from doing hypnotherapy, a novel approach to many out there. He's a professional therapist, coach, and NLP practitioner. And he is formally trained in both hypnosis, hypnotherapy training, and aforementioned NLP. He is also, might I say, a friend. A little disclaimer there up front, so the conversation might be skewed subjectively a little bit. But I'll back that up by saying he's one of the few people that I will actually refer people to. And I try to often. Some of them genuine. Some of them genuine clients. Some of the more hot potato clients as well that I think maybe Howard's a little more polite and professional to deal with. But, you know, this isn't something that I don't often do. You know, I could probably count on one hand the people that I will actually refer clients to. So Howard really is the real deal. When it comes to anxiety, city-based clients who really need professional service and someone who's going to care and pay attention to the clients, Howard is that guy for me, that go-to guy. So I'm very pleased to welcome Howard. Before I introduce him, I'll just give you a little bit more background on him. Howard Cooper is known for helping people, as I mentioned. He's created the rapid shifts in thinking over the last 20 years with these clients and has worked with thousands of individuals. He rejects the notion that deep and lasting change has to take a long time. And over the years, he's seen some incredible transformations. He's worked on Virgin Atlantic's Flying Without Fear course, writes magazine columns, talks about change on LBC, and even hosts his own podcast, Rapid Change Matters, which I believe I have been on. I have, haven't I? That is the Rapid Change, yep, to name a few. All this has gone into the melting pot that is Howard's experience, which he is now keen to share with others in the business. And one more before I do introduce him, if anyone was fortunate to have been in the audience at the 2023 UK Hypnosis Convention, they would have seen just what, and James touched on this actually on the previous podcast, just what a great presenter Howard is. And he's not only great in that he's absolutely born to present to the masses, but he actually cares, and there's a congruency with the thing that he's teaching as well. So hopefully we'll touch on that when we talk, but a warm and happy welcome to my friend Howard Cooper.
Oh, thank you, Nick. That is quite an intro. I don't know how to top it. I couldn't have written that intro if I'd written it better myself.
Parts of it you did.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
There we go.
Good.
None of the gushy stuff. Now we're in a bit of a rush because, as I say, Howard is actually a busy therapist.
Yep.
He's the busy therapist. When we're gonna have a chat, and hopefully you're gonna talk about meta suggestions and willingness, and obviously the willingness ladder, which is something which you share to other therapists and coaches. Yeah. So tell us a little more.
Oh man, meta suggestions. I've been playing around with this idea for a little while, which is certainly as hypnotists, we're often very focused on what are the suggestions that we're giving them, the direct suggestions. But I think there's this area where it's really useful to look deeper at, which is underneath all of the suggestions, what are we really implying in the way that we conduct ourselves in a session, in the way that we orientate things? So for example, let's say someone comes to see you and says that they have intrusive thoughts and they need to get rid of these intrusive thoughts. And we, as therapists, we seem very concerned about it. And we get very caught up in, oh, how long has this been going on for? And, oh, my word, you really are suffering, aren't you? And then we buy into the idea that I'm going to have to help you get rid of these intrusive thoughts. Well, aren't the meta suggestions actually deep down that we're corroborating in the way that we're handling that? We're corroborating the idea that those thoughts are in fact dangerous and threatening and have some credibility over them. So then the whole direction of the therapy is Let's get rid of these thoughts, imagining them then getting further and further away, letting them go into balloons and float away, mm-hmm. dissolve it, and so on. But all of that's really doing is communicating deep down that there really is a threat and that these thoughts have some power over them. And I think we need to be really careful. So there are lots of examples of that kind of thing in action, but I think not enough people pay attention to the kind of deeper undercurrents of suggestion that are leaking through in the way they even construct a solution for the problem. I've had a long-standing idea that I believe, and I think this is pretty much true for every issue that I've come across, which is I believe the client's perceived solution to the issue is the problem. So, for example, if someone comes and says, you know, I need to stop smoking, what do they think they need? What's their perceived solution? They think they need to get rid of the cravings. But actually, the moment we start orientating, as we talked about, to getting rid of cravings, aren't we actually corroborating the idea that cravings have some power over them? And therefore, the only way they could have success in the future is if they never, ever have a craving, rather than learning about the psychological resilience that's needed to, what if I could just have the feeling of I want a cigarette and I don't do it anyway? I think it's much more helpful to lead people towards psychological resilience in those very mm-hmm. integrative ways, rather than trying to do the magic trick of you'll never have a craving again. And again, this is kind of what I've been pointing at in a lot of the work recently in the last couple of years that I've been doing.
Yeah, I think when people come with acute anxiety, which you are, you know, you're known for yeah. treating successfully, and depression and stuff like that as well. I think a lot of therapists, especially people starting out, I was guilty of it myself as well. They don't do the homework about intrusive thoughts as well, right? That they're actually a natural occurrence, even for very happy and balanced people.
Right,
and then they come to a naive therapist, or albeit a well-meaning one, and they don't actually look at the practical realities of a lot of these negative and intrusive thoughts, or they don't look at the wider environment that person's living in, and you know, hopefully we'll go on and right. talk about some of the other stuff, but
well, I think it's that kind of idea. I've had a lot of people over, because of my Virgin Atlantic links in the past, I've had a lot of people come to see me for a fear of flying. And there's a lot of people who will say to me something along the lines of, Howard, make me like all the people who are okay flying, who never have a negative thought about flying. And that's really interesting, you know, because I'll say to them, go and find someone who's okay flying, and then ask them this question. Have you ever had a negative thought about flying? Like, what if we crashed? What if there was turbulence? Exactly, what if the plane was cancelled? And they'll all go, well, of course. And then you get curious. You lean in and you go, so go on, tell me. What technique do you use in order not to freak out when that thought appears? And I swear they'll all look at you and they'll go, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It never even struck them that they had to do a technique, because they know they're just kind of thinking, but they're not orientating towards, I have to get rid of all negative thoughts, because if we did that, we'd likely be giving it too much credibility.
Mm. Yeah, no, 100%. And I think this is, and you know, we're talking about anxiety, but like you said, smoking, anything really.
Right.
I think one of the things you said before, you use the expression of therapists getting in their own way. These issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happens a lot. And it happened with me when I first started out, you know, because it's kind of funny. I've had a lot of people ask me about, like, what do you do if someone comes to you with something really serious? Like, as though there's a distinction to make between, like, the suffering someone has with one set of thoughts versus another set of thoughts. You know, and I think, look, there's a metaphor I often go into with people, which is, you know, if my son comes running into my bedroom one night and says, Daddy, there's a monster under my bed. How effectively would it help him if I said, George, there's no monster, but whatever you do, don't look it in the eyes. In telling him he mustn't see it, it would add credibility to it. But I think if you're a parent, how do you best show your kids that there's no monster under the bed? Well, you have to know there's no monster under the bed too. And I think so many therapists, you know, when they raise, like, I've had suicidal thoughts, if the therapist is going to go, oh, God,
yeah,
this is a serious one, in having that response, they're not best placed to help that person, because actually what they're now going into is the meta pattern or the meta suggestion of, this is a really big, serious issue. And I've already bought into the fact that this is problematic, and rather than being unfazed, right, they're just falling for some thoughts.
Yeah. And that is very much all they are doing. You know, suicidal ideation is a lot more common than people think. And yet they'll go in and they'll give it, again, not picking on the more inexperienced therapists, but they will get that recoil in horror. Instead of the, you know, actually just giving them the facts, educating them that a lot of people, a lot of happy people, a lot of balanced people do have suicidal ideation.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, if we're faced by it as therapists, we probably shouldn't be working with it. You know, and yeah. I think a lot of therapists end up not really doing therapy on the client, dare I say. They're actually doing therapy on themselves. Because they're trying to, like, seek resolution for some internal shadow work that's going on for them in their dynamic.
Well, the first thing they do is they totally dissociate from the moment. Like, they're looking for, how have I got to be with this person here? Because deep inside, I'm shitting the pants.
Yeah.
That I'm not equipped to do with it. And I don't, you know, I think, especially for people starting out, even if they've had the best training in the world, at that point, have no shame in referring on.
Right.
But refer on with an intention to either learn from the person you're referring on to, because I believe you should have a connection with the person you're referring on to. Otherwise, you're just pissing in the wind a little bit with whether, you know, and I joked about referring people on to you, but that's because I know two things. One, you care about the people that are going to be sat in front of you. And two, you have got the experience and the humility to do the right thing for that person, which isn't the same as the former. But if I didn't know you, I wouldn't refer on to you. You know, even because, as we'll probably discuss, titles, credentials mean very little compared to experience.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of funny to me that you see people on hypnosis forums posting, and it's often like, it's like, I'm seeing a client tomorrow on bedwetting or on intrusive thoughts or flying. And has anyone got the script for that? First of all,
the script.
But also, what it strikes me as being, and no one ever talks about this, it's like, in order for that person to have booked in, have they spoken to that person before? Likely, maybe, I don't know about you, but I have a chat with someone on the phone. They say, can you help? And then I tell them how they can book in, and we have a little chat. So has that person actually had a conversation with someone, said they can help, taken their money, had them book in, and then the day before,
and then
now
the question
or the script? It's like, if you haven't worked with it, you can't work with it, or you're going to have to, if you're essentially, you know, backup plan is to post anonymously on a forum saying, has anyone got the script? Why are you taking someone's money?
Now, listen, I've been there myself, right? So we're not bashing newbies. I'm sure you've been there, Howard, in your, you know, your evolution into a good therapist.
Absolutely.
And as you're talking, I perhaps have probably the funniest and most painful, excruciating example of, I'll grab the script on the morning, and I'll just wing it, because all I've been used to now, and what happens is, you do actually find that to a lot of people, and it's for other reasons that in retrospect you then learn to do with other things, to do with connection, they're to do with rapport and what have you, just being present with people. There's so many things that are also contributing to successful therapy that you actually think these scripts do work. And I had one where it was a really old guy, and perhaps there was a bit of me that just didn't want to deal with it until the moment, but he was kind of slightly immobile. In like his mid-80s, he just, he sort of had a wife that couldn't, or their relationship wasn't a physical one, but he'd stayed with her over the years. His wife was pretty much on the way out, and he developed a friendship with a younger woman in her 70s. And all of a sudden, Mr. Happy wasn't working for him. And he, so I was like, I'm not going to think about this now. I'll just turn up. And I turned up. But for people who can't see, Howard's already laughing. But I wasn't laughing at the time. It was excruciating to begin with because I'm so arrogant. I haven't even read this script. And, you know, I start going through the patter. I do an induction. The induction's fine. And then I start reading the script, and it's literally like a Mills and Boone thing that I'm trying to get this very, like, 30-year flaccid man pumped. And then
was it hard to sort out?
It was hard to spit out, and excuse the expression, but it was just absolutely awful. And I could hear my words grinding to a halt. And then the guy looked up because he's obviously picking up on the pain and the squirming that I'm in. And I just laughed and I just said, I'm so sorry. And that for me was a real wake up call. I mean, it gave me a funny anecdote that I still use now, 11, 12 years later, but it gave me a wake up call to do your homework and stay in your lane as well. I mean, I just wasn't that guy to treat that guy for that problem.
But
subsequently, I did help him with his golf swing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, So because we stuck up a friendship, you know, I said, look, I'm not taking your money. That was terrible. I really shouldn't have even tried that. I was very honest with him. And he called me later. He's quite an active guy for his age. And he developed a yip. I think it was the boner getting in the way of the swing. But But it was a real lesson for me. And I think that's what you're saying is a really important lesson about the scripts, that do your homework.
It is. But I also think, and again, yeah, it's not that I'm, because someone might hear me saying that and go, well, what, you know, you've never worked with a different area that you've never worked with before. How do you manage? Like, but I think there's a level of ethics and honesty needed. So
honesty. Yeah.
I have some people who will ring me. I had a mother ring me a few months ago. Her son is on the cusp of OCD, getting an OCD and Tourette's diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Have I worked with Tourette's before? No. Have I even thought about it? No. Do I even believe it's possible? I don't know. It's not something like I've had. If you'd have rung me and said, look, I've got a fear of flying, can you help? I can literally go, I've helped with thousands of people with that. Here's the process. Here's how it works. But I've been recommended by someone, and she had this sneaking suspicion. She said that it was anxiety based and it wasn't Tourette's. The ticking was something else. And I said to her, just really honestly, I said, look, if you'd rung me and said, I've got a fear of flying, here's what I would have said. But you haven't. You rung me with this. I don't really know. Do I have some skills that may be able to be of use? Perhaps. Happy to meet, happy to see, to explore if he's up for it. I had a little preamble with chat with this 12-year-old kid. He seemed to like me. But I said, let's just do a session, speak a week later, see how he's got on. If it's been of value, then great, we can do something else. If there's no change at all, let me refer you on. But I do want you to know, going into it, this is much an experimentation for me as it is for you. And if you're okay on that basis, I am too. And she was like, no, I've heard good things about you. I want to say them to you. And he liked you on the intro. That's fine. But now I also, it takes the pressure off me to have to pretend to be the expert on this in the moment, which I also think gets in the way.
Yeah, no, listen, that sounds very similar to the approach that I used to take. You know, let's have a play. Oh, I'm fascinated. I'd love to, you know, I haven't experienced that. Let's have, you know, I'm curious.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. But I think you used the two words that unfortunately are very often, or too often missing, which is ethics and honesty.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that it circles back to that thing about therapists getting in their own way.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's necessarily therapists' faults either. Like, if you look at the state of a lot of training out there, people go and they often start the world because they want to be therapists, and they go into the world of therapy because they genuinely want to help people. That's great. They end up going on trainings, and what they see are trainers who are regurgitating perhaps old school ideologies and old school stuff, but also because they haven't done the work or they're not comfortable with demoing stuff, dare I say. They hand select demo subjects from the audience on the training. Yeah. They daren't fail in front of anybody. And what ends up coming across is this idea that if you want to be a good therapist, You have to end up being a trainer who absolutely knocks it out the park with every single demo subject, and you will have a 100% fix with every single person. And if you can't, then you're probably not a good therapist. You're not a good change worker. You're certainly not like the masters that have taught you. And so there's a huge amount of pressure for people who, like, if they don't realize, it's bullshit. Mm. And there is a therapist out there who hasn't, like, screwed up from time to time with clients and not helped someone, and it hasn't kind of resonated. Like, it would be really hard to go into every session feeling like I must help this person 100% get over this. Otherwise, it means something about me. Now it's my internal issues going on, nothing to do with the client.
Yeah, and if you've been in a position where you've seen enough clients, you'll know that there are a certain number of clients that don't want to be helped anyway.
Right, absolutely. They collect up therapists that they've taken down like a notch on their belt.
Yeah.
Another one down.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah, no, there's some people that absolutely love the process.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't take that personally.
But going back a second, it was funny because you said something about in a session, I think the best place for clients to be, for change workers to be, is actually present in the session. And so often they're not, because they're in their head going, what's my next move? And what does this say about me if I can't help them? And which means they're not actually there. And a really good example of this is the skill of rapport building that people are taught.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we're taught on trainings. I mean, I was taught on an NLP trainings, many, many of them that I went. And then I even helped assist run these courses and found myself teaching other people this stuff. If you want to build rapport, you mirror and match them. So when they go and scratch their face, you scratch your ass. And if they scratch their ass, you scratch your ear. That's cross matching. That's advanced. You know, basic matching is just they scratch their face, you scratch yours. I was doing advanced stuff. Scratch their face, you scratch your ass. You know, and so on. That's advanced stuff.
While looking at their IQs.
Absolutely. And here's what happens. Them. You got the change worker sitting fresh out of these trainings, sitting with their client. And while the person's telling them their story or something really important to them, they're sitting going, did they nod? Yes, they nodded. Now I nod. Now I shake my leg. Now I move my left head slight angles to the left, to the right. And they think that's rapport. But what was interesting about NLP, my journey of learning that, do you know what? No, it's only dawned on me years later. Do you know what no one ever suggested that you do on an NLP training? If you want to build rapport with someone, take a fucking interest in your client.
Yeah.
Like, actually just show real interest and be genuinely interested. I find, like, if you're just genuinely interested and want to help someone, you know, it's then easier to build rapport without having to, like, modulate, mechanically be in pace with the nodding of the head.
I cannot agree more. I mean, let's put it this way. Let's just say someone comes back to you, which you would have experienced, I would have experienced, not maybe for the same issue, maybe for another issue, maybe.
No, never for the same issue, because I have a 100% success rate with all the clients that I've ever worked with in often half an hour. Even though I book out more time, it's just because I'm very fast and efficient. No.
Yeah, since I learned just that little nudge of that little finger could cure everything. No one ever comes back. No, but you might remember a detail about them.
100%.
But here's the thing. If you are a busy therapist, and you're probably not, but if you are a busy therapist, again, it goes back to do your homework. Look up that person. Go over your notes if you've still got them. And that's the way to make connection. So even if you are being a little bit deceptive, but looking like you're interested, looking like you had that personal connection with that person, it is going to go a lot further, like you said, than following where their eyeballs are tracking, or crossing their legs, or when they uncross their legs, etc. Now, another thing that I know... God, sorry.
I was going to say, it's not that those things per se, like having similar body movements and knowing and having an awareness of eye accessing cues, it's not that they have no value. It's that a lot of courses, what they do is they teach you that stuff, and they think that the end goal is to spot it.
Yeah.
But it's not. The end goal is to get so good at spotting it that you start doing it and responding to it unconsciously without you having to think consciously about it. Because the moment you think consciously about it, you're not actually with them anymore.
Yeah, 100%. And do you know what? I think where this is a really profound example of this, and I know you and I agree to a certain degree on it is those therapists that work with ISEs and root cause.
Right. Yep.
Now, if you take the most extreme version of that, you have one of the training schools that I was very periodically in a low point in my life, one of their certified trainers. Thank you. You helped me through that tough time. But they've done it where they've given so much for that therapist to think about that they've actually got it ISO 9000 certified. So it is a rigid managerial process. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's your first training in hypnosis and you're given this thing, which is basically what, you know, how you get to the root cause, you know, how you regress to cause, unless you're a very natural person, you are literally not present at all. And not only are you not present at all, but you're not present at all and creating a situation where that person can become extremely vulnerable.
Yep.
And so it's a double kick in the nuts for the client in front of you. So yep. I know you and I have discussed it before. You know, what are your hang-ups about the ISE brigade? And
well, I'll tell you, and by the way, just to loop back to meta suggestions that people come out in a session, let's imagine there was no ISE. There was no significant event that had occurred, and someone over time has just generically developed something. Well, they're falling for some intrusive thinking and they've got into some unhelpful patterns, and there isn't really a one trigger memory. And then they go and they see someone who's going to do regression to cause and they cannot find it. Mm. Because guess what? There isn't one. But if they can't find it, now they go away. It might be that you say, well, it didn't work. Right? They didn't take any suggestions. They were not a good hypnotic subject. Except here's the downside. They might have taken a suggestion. They might have taken the suggestion that there really is one cause, one root cause, and they can't possibly get better until they find it, which is really problematic if there isn't one. If there isn't one. Because now they're going to spend their whole life being stuck going, and I've had people call me and say, Howard, I've been to see a few therapists and they said they couldn't find the root cause. They couldn't find it. But I do know that I have to uncover it in order to get better. What a meta suggestion. You are now stuck unless you can't find the thing that doesn't exist. It's like
you're both stuck.
Everyone's stuck, yeah?
The client's stuck because they know you're looking for it.
Yep.
You're stuck. And also a third part of that as well, and this goes back to something you said earlier in the conversation, with the regression to cause and looking for ISEs and that, and even worse, past life regression and what have you, it is when that client presents, this is how I want something to be dealt with. And, you know, again, we see it on groups, you see it on social media groups. Can someone recommend a past life? You know, I have a client who wants this. And I just won't indulge with that. Well, sometimes I'll just argue the other side of it, but a lot of the times I won't indulge with it. I've never passed it on. And even to people that I know who, for all intents and purposes, are decent people, but they're doing an injustice to a client if they indulge that client whims.
I truly, truly do believe, and I said it earlier, but I'll say it again, the client's perceived solution of what they think they need is the problem. If they ring up and they go, I need the root cause. Like the fact that they are that caught up in some story that some unfound past event is the problem and that they need to helping them.
Although ironically, they've probably told you what the problem is there.
Yes. Yeah.
In that instance.
But how about this, right? So I've had arguments with therapists about this, but let's do a really nice tangible root cause story for a second and unpick it. Imagine someone comes to see you and they've been absolutely fine flying on a plane until the age of 16, they report. And at the age of 16, they go on a short flight and it's very, very, and they're fine there, but then on the way back, it's very turbulent. They get very freaked out. They land and now they're terrified of flying. Well, most people might say, would they know? Well, it's a simple root cause, isn't it? Like the turbulent flight that they had caused their fear and phobia. But my question is this, if that's really true, are we saying that all 300 people on that flight are now afraid of flying?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that. I think there'll be some people who were unaffected on that flight. So then the question would go, well, why is it then that he is amongst the people on that flight who now won't fly again after that turbulence? Well, probably because there were certain things neurologically, his brain was wired up in a particular way that meant that he was going to receive that turbulence in a way that more coded it as a threat. So what happened that made that the case? Well, maybe he'd read an article a few weeks earlier about the dangers of traveling on a plane or turbulence, or he'd met a friend. Okay, but why, when his friend had told him that they were on a turbulent flight, which had primed the pump, dare I say, why had his brain flagged that up as something to pay attention to unconsciously a bit? Well, maybe it's because his father, when he was young, and the moment you start playing that game, it's like, well, even the simplest of root causes, you start to realize, no, it's just, it's like trying to grab sand that's coming through your fingers. There isn't, 100%. You can't pinpoint and go, it's that one bit or it's that one bit. So I have a kind of a stock phrase. If anyone says, I want the root cause, I really need it. And I go, I can see I'm not going to win you over about the fact that you don't need a root cause. So let me give you it now, and then we can just move on.
Yeah.
Your root cause is simple. You're human. And everything that's ever happened since the beginning of life itself, from amoebas coming out of the ocean and developing legs and crawling, and then with us evolving into humans, combined with culturally, geographically, historically, biologically, every impact that's ever happened on you has led you to this time and space where, for various reasons, your brain has formed and created patterns that are resulting in the feelings that you have right now. So that's the root cause. Now let's move on.
And sadly, 50% will be, yeah, buts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And then do you want to work with those people anyway?
Well, but you know what? I mean, I have, in terms of people seeing me, I've got my website talks about who shouldn't see me as much as who should see me. And they arrange a 15-minute initial chat, and we have a little chat on the phone, and I weed out those people who want me to wave a magic wand and just fix them, or I don't think it's going to be a good fit. And I'm also listening to people. Do they have a sense of humor? Do they follow instruction? You know, it's like, if you can't go through a simple process where you fill out one form and book a call with me and then answer some simple questions on a call, how successful is this going to be when I ask them to do other things in a session? So for me, it's, you know, I've had people say, I recommended you to my friend. Can you give her a ring? No, like, tell them there's my website. Because there is something about them going on the site, having to click on the button to fill out the form, going through the process. It shows that they're engaged in the process. It's just too easy for them. If it's just, I'd have to ring them and say, please, can you come? Please, will you let me help you? Please.
But you know what? This is really, really, really good advice, you know, for especially the newbies and people just getting starting their own practices and this and the other. Don't not only filter yourself, but don't be afraid to filter yourself, but don't be afraid to filter your clients as well, because they're the thing that is going to demoralize you at the end of the day. They're the thing that is going to sow seeds of doubt in your mind. You know, give yourself a chance, give them a chance of success by working with the right clients. There's no shame in that. You know,
I had a guy that rang me out the blue, right? He rang me out the blue. Don't know how he got my number, because I don't have it publicly available, because I want
it. Wasn't one of my referrals, was it?
I think it was, actually. No. It was really, I was literally walking back. It was about 10 to 6, 5 to 6. Mm-hmm. I was walking home from my office, and I know in about 6 minutes I'm going to enter the house. And I'm going to be mobbed by, at that time, I've got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old who, if you walk in at that and you haven't been there today, you know, who I don't give a shit that I'm on the phone. I know whoever's on the phone is going to hear, Daddy, I did a big high school. Like, I don't want that. So he rings at like 5 to 6 and he said, you do hypnotherapy, I've heard. Yes, who's calling? We'll get to that in a moment. How much do you charge? I said, well, look, it's obvious that you've got, you're looking for some help for yourself, is that, or for someone else? Yeah, it's for me. How much do you charge? Well, look, I'm really happy to go through how I charge, the program, how I work, see if there's a good fit, find out a bit more about you. But normally what happens is people book in at a time that's convenient for both you and I, because if you could see me right now, I'm literally walking home. I'm about to be mobbed on my kids in like 2 or 3 minutes, and we won't have time to go through what we need to go through to check that to give you the information you need to make sure there's a good fit. So when's a good time to arrange a proper chat? Just tell me how much is it and where are you based? And I just said, rightly or wrongly, because I was getting irritated, my thought was, if you can't follow this simple piece of information, which actually is for his benefit, right? And also, I don't charge by the one session or the... It's just not the way I do things. But if you can't follow instructions now, do I want this person coming and sitting in the office who's being objectionable right up front, who's being difficult, who's making me feel like I'm... And I just said to him, I said, let me cut to the chase. I said, there's no point in telling you how much it is. Well, of course there's a point, because how will I know whether to decide I want to see you? Or I said, there's no point because I don't think I want to see you.
Mm.
And he was so upset. You know, it's like, how can you speak to me like that? And it was like, well, I think you set the precedence. Thank you for your interest. That was it.
I think some of the ones I experienced similar to that as well. Not all. I wouldn't. Not even perhaps a majority, but a lot of them were actually drunk as well. Where they have that.
Right.
I tend to. Maybe it's just me. Maybe they gravitate.
You attract them into your life. You've been manifesting.
Yeah. Maybe it's Maybe it's my throbbing red nose and cheeks that they saw something in them. But I would have a lot of belligerence and that with people ringing up in that moment, and again doing exactly what you did, because you know they're not calling back in the next morning.
Well, also, I mean, I will say, if anyone's listening to this and they're kind of new and they think, oh, shit, I don't want to take any calls now. That is like, that is the worst I've had. It's never been as bad as that. And 99.9% of them are all like genuinely nice people who are looking for some help and support.
Yeah, you'll get the odd space cadet leave a message like 2 o'clock in the morning as well, which, you know, they're great.
Yeah.
Client confidentiality, you play them to all your friends and family and then delete them off your... That was a joke, by the way, your answer machine.
I got a message from someone who I'd done a 50-minute initial chat with, and I'd said, I don't think this is going to be a good fit, but I've got lots of free resources on TikTok, on YouTube. There's a webinar that I can give you access to, which is a free webinar, and I think these things will help. But at this stage, I don't think we're a good fit for the one-on-one work. And they were based overseas. And then she messaged me, because she had my number now, with a text, just a quick question. And I say foolishly, because I do try and help where I can, because I do care. And I went back and said, well, no, just, you know, I would do such and such a thing, you know, and that's that. And then 2 o'clock in the morning, I got another message on my phone, and it said something, it was a text with another question. Another question, how long do you think I should do the exercises for? And then, no shit, I hadn't responded. You know why? Because I was asleep. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, England time. So it might be 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock where they are, but I haven't responded. And then I wake up in the morning and there's like five or six further messages from them going, you're not replying. You bill yourself as a change worker, someone who cares, and you haven't even responded to me. And I'm like, she's had this whole like conversation about my unprofessionalness and all of these things in the middle of the night. I'm not even present for any of this. This is like this whole diatribe. It's a bit bizarre.
Yeah. I think you have to be careful as well. It's like when you're working with depressed people, you know, you don't want them to feel a detachment from you. You want that, you know, that human connection is a really big part of the process of them changing course and getting better, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of doing, you know, the message me, call me anytime. If I see it, I'll try and respond. And for all the best intentions in the world, that will create more problems.
It will.
You know, you're perpetuating that person neediness. You're not working on resilience. There's a very little you can do at midnight or 11 o'clock at night or even first thing in the morning. So, you know, don't be afraid. Don't, you know, there's that worry that therapists who care what's going on with that client. But it can be all consuming, and it did for me a few years ago. So I think it can be. You know,
I've also noticed that sometimes people will have like a crisis moment, and they'll reach for the phone and they'll text the therapist. They'll text me. I've just had a bit of a thing. And is this normal? And if you don't respond, and I don't mean out of rudeness, it's out of compassion for letting them try and figure this out for themselves. Nine times out of 10, they've often messaged back without me saying anything at all, 24 hours later, and say, oh, sorry to have bothered you yesterday. I was just having a bit of a moment, worked through it now. Like, and that's great because you haven't had to do anything. You know, they kind of worked it through. And more often than not, they kind of get themselves there. And it's better to speak to them after they've had a chance to work it out for themselves rather than dive in and play the knight in shining armor, which is something that I've always struggled with because I want to help. And you hear the call of desperation and, okay, I'll help.
Yeah, but at some point you have to take stock and reflect on yourself and say you're probably not helping them.
Yeah,
and you're not helping yourself either. Now, one way you do help, you know, you've touched on this anyway, is, you know, you've explained that people's own neurology gets in their way or they're afraid of their own neurology. And what you've developed is something called the willingness ladder, which is, I can say from some of our peers and people in the community, has been hugely well received as a training program because it's actually based on working with people as opposed to many of the protocols and bullshit that's out there. This is something that has been years, 20 years in the making, and it's the influences have come from other people. Tell us a little bit about the willingness ladder.
So I have kind of like two parts to my therapeutic life and journey. I started off very much as an NLP-er, hypnotist, more direct suggestions. Then back in 2016, 2017, I came across the work of Jürgen Rasmussen, international Nordic god. I don't think he's ever been called that before. I don't know why that popped up.
No.
There you go. Why not? Why not?
He's been called Nordic.
Nordic, yeah, he's from Norway, and he wrote Provocative Hypnosis, and it was around the time I was setting up the podcast that you, your esteemed self, also came on. But I read his book, Provocative Hypnosis, invited him onto the show, and we hit it off and on camera in terms of I liked the way he thought. And after I then saw him at the UK Hypnosis Convention, the first one, doing a demo of something he referred to as the psychological illusion model, I flew him over to England and put together a training. We had about 40 people turn up to a three-day event where he taught his psychological illusion model for the first time. And it just blew me away, and in terms of changing the way I kind of orientated. And so he's been a big influence on the way I do things. And at the beginning of COVID, I saw him do a demo. And we would often talk as well, because he's sort of been informally a mentor of mine over the last sort of 5 years or so. But I saw him do this demo with someone, and I'll always remember it because it didn't make any fucking sense to me. He was working with someone who I think was very psychologically minded, had done a lot of kind of self-study and meditation and self-inquiry stuff. And I remember him saying he was very anxious about getting a feeling of he couldn't breathe, because during COVID, that could mean he would worry that meant that, is that his lungs shutting down? Is that COVID? Is that the virus spreading? And Jürgen just asked him two questions. Do you want that feeling? And the guy went, no. And then Jürgen looked at him in that sort of inquisitive way and went, could you be willing to have it? And the guy went, yes, I could. Amazing. It's gone. I just feel amazing now. And I went, what the fuck just happened there? I don't understand that. But of course, like anyone who sees something interesting and new, I would sit with clients that walk in and then go, I've got terrible intrusive thoughts. And I'd go, do you want those thoughts? And they go, no. And I'd look at them with my best Jürgen face and go, could you be willing to have them? And they look at me and go, no. And I go, oh, well, that doesn't work. And I tried that four or five times with people and thought, oh, that's irritating. So I went back and watched the video again of Jürgen doing it. And I'm like, I think it became this thing that I became fascinated with the demo subject that he'd used. He really had gone from, I don't want this, to I'm willing to have it. And in that willingness, all the kind of resistance and the tension gone. But I was like, well, what are the mental shifts that he has done in his head, whether it was explicitly demonstrated or led through by Jürgen or not, but what did he have to do to get from I don't want that to I'm willing to have it? What? And it suddenly dawned on me that, well, one of the things you'd have to do is to realize that, like, for example, you don't really have a choice of what thoughts appear. Like, if you don't choose your thoughts, it's much easier to realize that, like, you could just accept them appearing, and then you kind of have to tolerate it because you don't really have a say over it. So, all right, so now I'd be with people and I'd be going from, do you want that? But do you choose to have them? And then we'd explore that. Now could you be, no, not quite yet. So it was more about me getting really curious about what are the psychological tiny little steps mm-hmm. that you can take anyone and they'll kind of follow you from, I don't want that thought or experience, all the way through to not just I'm willing to have it, but actually I can look forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the mental shifts. And I kind of figured out there's six questions. So in six questions, you can usually take people, regardless of the issue, it's pretty versatile, from I don't want those, that experience, those thoughts, all the way through to I can look forward to it. And funnily enough, once they were able to look forward to the thoughts appearing that in the past caused the problem, the thoughts tend to appear less anyway, but not because they're trying to get rid of them, because genuinely they've seen that there's no threat. But yeah, the whole willingness ladder was born out of just getting, like, modeling someone else and figuring out how, like, it worked on that occasion with that one person. But
yeah,
there's got to be a way of making this appropriate for people that aren't psychologically minded or haven't quite made those connections yet. And I have been absolutely bowled over by the impact it seems to have had by people in the profession. I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen C. Hayes, who created the field of ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, who seems to really like it. I'm talking with him about writing a foreword to a book on it as well. And yeah, just people sharing cool results.
And the difference is, you know, what people do is the bad trainers, who, let's be honest, probably don't have a thriving practice, probably don't see people on a regular basis. They model, but they just model and repackage. They don't ask questions yep. why. And what Howard's just explained, I think, is really important for anyone to listen in. The important key stage is Howard trying, making mistakes, you know, reflecting on it, asking why, then reapplying it into a real world scenario, working with clients in front of him, and then sort of recalibrating it and refining it along the way. And that's
literally
how,
about
that's
2 years.
A good process, yeah. And
it was
and
literally
I think
about
that, you know,
2 years, and it gradually emerged.
Yeah. Whereas a lot of people who are selling training that isn't worth a toffee are literally laying in bed thinking of something and then trying to package a story around it. Whereas you've wanted to lift up the hood and understand why it works, why it gets you from A to B, and then also how it affects other people. And from the feedback that I've got, it is exceptional. And even, you know, from people who are probably, you would call, direct suggestion therapists and hypnotists and what have you, you know, that it's been universally received with positive feedback. So we're right. going to share a link at the end of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll I can't urge people enough to actually learn from you, because it comes from a good place as well, trying to improve people's lives, which is hopefully the end goal for any of these training programs. Now, you mentioned Jorgen as an influence. Who else would you say is a?
Erickson. You know, I have a soft spot for Dr. Milton H. Erickson, as many of us do. The reality of it is, it's more the stories and the apocryphal tales of him I've fallen in love with. I'm never quite sure how true some of them are. And I also think that they're slightly overinflated in that, like, if you stop and think about it, people talk about, you know, him being the wonderful and the great, and I think he absolutely was. But that also doesn't mean that he helped everybody in a second.
No.
There are cases where he talks about, you know, they came in, you know, it was 12 hours in before they began to make any progress and so on. And it's very easy to pull out the magic and the stories of the wizard of the desert. And these, you know, he'd say one thing or look in a particular way and something cool would happen. But I think there also is just there was real, like, time and effort and graft of sitting and figuring shit out and doing it with clients week in, week out, and seeing them repeatedly and getting them to know them, and not sitting there scratching his butt because they scratched their face.
Yeah, I think there's a mythology that's developed around Erickson. and it's been translated really badly into, and then it leads back to what you were saying, people trying to do an impersonation of Ericsson. Going to get themselves some polio. Going full method on it. Yeah, growling, growing a moustache.
Most people are not doing impressions of Ericsson. They do impressions of Bandler doing impressions of Ericsson.
Or worse.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't think those words have been said often, but yeah, or worse. Because, you know, they are so detached and not present.
But it doesn't mean I don't love the guy. I think it's brilliant, you know, and I didn't watch
exactly.
It's a great documentary called The Wizard of the Desert.
Do you know what? It's actually, the actual fascination is trying to sift through what the magic is. With the backdrop that it wasn't 100%, you know, it didn't always work.
Well, they often talk about NLP and I think the quote, and I'm probably going to muller this quote, so forgive me, but he talks about the boys, as in Grinder and Bandler, who developed NLP. But when they studied Ericksonian hypnosis and they studied him, they took the nut, but they took the shell, but threw away the nut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the idea that what they have is this packaging system of you do this, you do that, you do the other. But the very core and the essence was kind of missed. And actually, in many ways, I've seen on a few forums when people have talked about the willingness ladder, people have said, can someone just share the 6 questions? As though the questions are the magic. They're not. The questions aren't the magic. If someone wants the questions, I'll give them the questions because the questions are the shell. And the magic is all the stuff that happens in between the questions. The questions are just a check-in to kind of where are they at in this process. But everything else is all the bits of business that is almost nuanced and that's why, you know, you could take the 6 questions, run through them, nothing's going to happen. As I found out when I went after seeing Jürgen going, do you want that? No. Could you be willing to have it? No. And I'm going, oh, doesn't work. Because I was throwing away the magic.
And like listening to you, that magic, the nut, is the failures. The white didn't work.
Yes.
The nuance and stuff like that. And so many of these training things, you know, they can do a shift or fire an arrow or what have you, and there is no nuance. They've been created with an imagination and nothing else.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely urge anyone and everyone who wants to be a better therapist to enroll on one of your next classes. And the one you're doing with James as well I know it's a bit late now, a bit late in the
it
day.
Is.
And
I think
you probably sold out anyway, but you know, that confidence, which is the other thing, you know, it's no coincidence that you and James collaborate together a lot because you both care about the subject in front of you.
Yes.
And I think that is what makes what you do together special. I've had the pleasure of working with James. I blame him for COVID. Because we started doing team building exercises and then the world shut down. But
definitely his fault.
But he is an amazingly present individual. He is the master at getting feedback from people and working with that. You do it very eloquently in a therapeutic session just as well. So I imagine whoever is lucky enough to join your training is going to absolutely thoroughly enjoy it. We're going to have to wrap up soon because I know you're busy. I know you've got clients. I'm going to pretend I've got clients. Yeah, tell them to write. But just we've touched on them anyway. Just can you give us some very quick quick fire answers, some impressive applications of hypnosis and some gripes of hypnosis?
Impressive applications. I think the weirdest thing that I ever firsthand experienced was a wart. Not a genital one, on my hand. It had it for 3 years, and I was at a training on hypnosis. I wasn't even a demo subject. Someone was doing a demo on someone else about healing the body, and then I woke up the next morning and the wart had vanished. And to this day, I still don't really know and can't explain it, and it still doesn't match with my own understandings of how things should work. But that was kind of a cool experience of going, maybe we don't know everything that we think we know. And holding that space for a little bit of magic as well is kind of nice. There's just so many impressive. I don't know. I mean, I have to tell this kid that I work with who I didn't know whether it was going to do anything. and he was on the cusp of a Tourette diagnosis, and it was exploratory. Mother's rung me recently to say after that session, his tics have stopped totally. And that, again, is outside of my scope of exactly how and why that happened. I don't know, but it's really cool when it does.
And I know you've mentioned before allergies disappearing as well.
Oh, allergies disappearing.
I think that comes with a caveat, obviously, an ethical caveat.
Right. And also, but yeah, going back to meta suggestions, how about this? CBT practitioner who had seen someone that I ended up working with, and that's how I know about them. This person was, their issue was they were terrified of anaphylactic shock. However, they had no history of anaphylaxis at all. None. But if they saw a news item about someone had an anaphylactic shock over nuts, now they can't eat nuts. You know, if they saw, I think there was someone who had a problem with sesame seeds a few years back, made the news. Now that's it. Can't go near any sesame seeds. They have no allergies at all. None. Anyway, they've been working with a CBT practitioner, and I just love this. This idea of meta suggestions. What you need to do, they said, is that the therapist said, is you need to prove to yourself that you can eat nuts and that you won't have an anaphylactic shock. So what I want you to do is I want you to go to the hospital with your nuts and sit on the park bench outside the hospital where you try your nuts, because then you'll at least know if you eat the nuts and you do have a reaction, you're in the right place. And I'm like, well, talk about the suggestions that you have to now go to a hospital to try this so that you're there for the anaphylactic shock. Talk about the meta suggestions. It's like, not surprisingly, they couldn't bring themselves to do it. Anyway, that was just digression because you said allergies and we've been talking about meta suggestions.
I just know that we've spoken in the past. Right, so now let's talk on the gripes. We've touched on them anyway, but we've mentioned efficacy, obviously.
Right.
Claims about efficacy.
I'll tell you what gripes I've got. I've got a big gripe, a massive gripe. Automatic patterns, automatic behaviors, repetition. And what I mean by that is hypnotherapists who learn something and now that's it. It works with a few people and that becomes the thing they do over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And they will put up barriers to anything different, anything new, or anything that flies in the face of what they have been doing already. And I look back genuinely every year and I go, like, I hope that I'm doing different stuff. I hope that the stories, the metaphors, the moves, the nuances are developing, because I hate the idea that I look ahead and I'm just doing the same stuff over and over and over again. Because to me, that would mean that I've stopped learning. And I often jokingly talk on social media about the fact that I think one of the biggest things that gets in the way of people succeeding in life is when they suffer from premature closure. Premature closure. And it's that idea of you kind of get something and it kind of works or kind of fits together in your mind. And then you go, right, I know that now. And you lock down mentally the hatches and you button up the doors. And that's that. I am not learning anything new about that because now I know it. And people try and give you more information. But no, it's too late. I suffered from premature closure. And you're not open to hear anything different. And I think there's a lot of hypnotists out there and therapists that suffer like that. And
people have got to understand that how this is nurtured as well. It's twofold. You know, that sort of shut eye idea comes down. You then start seeing less people. And it is actually that number of people and that variety of client that is going to teach you or give you the best lesson that rigid way of working doesn't work. So you get in this spiral of failure that you've locked yourself in, and then you've basically locked out the people that are going to teach you, which are the clients. You've mentioned before, you know, some of the best inspirations and some of the best learning has come from clients. And if you are rigid in your thinking, you've literally just alienated all of those people that are going to teach you something new or challenge the way you thought about stuff before.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better.
Well, you probably could have, because you're much more eloquent and a better presenter than me. Now, listen, I'm going to have to wrap it up. I know you've
That's all right.
You're thin on time. I just want to say, I'm going to share the links. Whether you're listening on Spotify, it will redirect to the website. You're going to have links for Howard on social media and any of his upcoming trainings. Like I said, he's one of the few people that I will, without hesitation, refer people to. And he's also one of the very, very few people whose training I'd recommend, wholeheartedly recommend. It's an absolute pleasure. I always learn something when I'm talking to you, Howard. You're a great person to bounce ideas off of and to challenge my own ideas. So for that, I'm grateful. I hope people do the same when they're listening to the advice you're giving them. So that just leaves me to say thanks again. I hope to see you soon. It was a long time, and you know, to bump into you last November, it was it had been too long, hadn't it? So hopefully we can get together and connect before November. I'm hoping you'll be presenting again at the UKHC, because you went down a storm. It's an absolute pleasure. And we'll speak soon. Thank you for listening to the Hypnosis Discussion Network podcast. Links and additional information for all of our guests can be found on the website www.hypnosisdiscussionnetwork.com. All views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own. Until next time.